Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Joshua Youngkin. In June of this year, philosopher David Berlinsky spoke before a live Manhattan audience at a Socrates in the City event, hosted by humorist and biographer Eric Metaxas. Berlinsky's talk has been divided into three segments. In the previous segment, Berlinsky traced modern scientism and its antipathy to religious belief to the dawn of the Enlightenment. In the following, Berlinsky illustrates the ills of modern scientism with a look at the social phenomena of the new atheism, which he weighs in the balance and finds wanting.
Now, I think it's true that all men at some time doubt the existence of the deity, and some men at all times doubt the existence of the deity. I don't mean to say that this is good or bad. I think it's the human condition. We grope. We're in the dark. We're not sure of what we're doing. What is so curious is to look at the number of books affirming that science has shown that God does not exist. And that is a very emphatic declaration. It's like the declaration that there is no number between 4 and 5. That's a demonstrable fact. There is no natural number between 4 and 5. So these people are adopting a platform of declaration of some vigorous effect. What is so interesting is to see that directly after the books have made it to the bestseller list, in conversation, or in interviews, or in scribbles not widely noted, they walk that particular dog back discreetly. Before his death, I had an opportunity to debate Christopher Hitchens. He was at the time terribly sick, so I hold him to no account with respect to what he said. But having made an enormous success by means of the proposition God is not only not great, he's not there, Hitchens was asked how certain he was of this conclusion. And he said in his own inimitable fashion, "Well, it could be that there is something like a world spirit." That's a very different proposition from the proposition that God does not exist. Richard Dawkins has made a fabulous career writing about the inexistence of God. But when you look at his book, what you see is not a defense of the proposition God does not exist, but a defense of the proposition, well, probably he does not exist. To say probably he does not exist is not to achieve deductive certainty, because there are plenty of opinions which might suggest that probably he does exist. In case after case, it's apparent that this vigorous, ebullient defense of atheism, when examined, repairs to the standard view that human beings have held since time immemorial, which is, it could be, or on the other hand, maybe not. In a remarkable series of studies, Freud discussed the neurotic personality, and he made a striking observation. He said, so far as the neurotic personality goes, the neuroticism is expressed in a variety of ways. All of these symptoms serve one function psychoanalytically, and that is they're in the service of repression. And what is being repressed, it differs from patient to patient, largely unacceptable memories. And then Freud made a remark which distinguishes him as a profound and great thinker. He said, no matter what, the repressed has a way of returning. No matter how arduous the mechanism of repression is, there is always something at work known as the return of the repressed. When you look at the climactic enthusiasm for the new atheism, in London there's a bus with a placard on the side. God does not exist, have a great time. I'm paraphrasing. Although why God's existence should preclude having a good time, I'm not entirely clear. I would think you'd have a much better time if you were certain that God did exist. Nonetheless, the ebullience with which the new atheism is affirmed conforms perfectly to Freud's doctrine of the return of the repressed. Because as soon as the spotlight of publicity, which is necessary to sell books, is dimmed, and as soon as the lecture hall spotlight is diminished, every last one says what we all would say. Maybe, maybe not. Could be. Who am I to say? That is the return of the repressed. And that is a point of criticism of the doctrine that the sciences have a unique form of accessibility to reality. Because that doctrine is poisonous and untrue. That's one example. I would like to be allowed to offer you a few other examples. In the 18th century, a French philosopher, very clever, said, look, I've got a button here, right on my table. You press this button, you get anything you want, anything. Untold riches, the love of beautiful women, inexhaustible power, anything you want. The only slight impediment is that 10,000 miles away in China, a peasant will drop dead in his tracks. You will cause his death. The question that he raised is, who amongst us would refrain from pressing the button? And who amongst us would be content to have that button in wide currency? I've always thought that was a profound moral question. A profound moral question. A few years ago, and we're now spanning 300 years, a well-known cosmologist, speaking off the cuff, as almost everyone who says anything interesting about cosmology speaks off the cuff because the official doctrine is so absurd. Speaking off the cuff said, you know, I understand quantum mechanics and I sort of get all this stuff, but I have a simple-minded question. And you know, when anybody ever says, I have a simple-minded question, the question is not simple-minded, he's just embarrassed to ask it. Tell me, he talked to other cosmologists, tell me, you got the electron, right? It's going around, you know, whiz, 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 and it follows an orbit. And that orbit determines the chemistry of ordinary life. And that electron does the same thing all the time. What compels the electron to stay in its orbit? Notice the choice of words. What compels the electron to stay in its orbit? Notice the resonance. What compels us not to press the button? Notice the questions are the same. What is the source of binding compulsion, whether in the moral life or in physical life? Notice at once this transgresses the boundaries of Galileo's universe. This is not uniquely a question about the book of God's work, because we're talking about a moral issue. This is not uniquely a question about the physical world for the same reason. And yet, when you look at the logical form of the question, what compels the electron? And what's stopping you from pushing that button, killing a Chinese peasant, and making yourself infinitely rich? There is some compulsive force at work that we all recognize, but cannot name. There are attempts in the literature to make that clear, but they've all been failures. For example, we might say that the laws of nature owe their compelling force to their logical form. They're necessary, just like the laws of logic. The trouble with that theory is they're not necessary. We can very easily imagine an alternative to the laws of nature as we understand them. And by the same token, we cannot say the laws of moral life, the compelling force that stops us from killing an innocent victim simply to enrich ourselves, are necessary. They could be otherwise. We cannot appeal to necessity of any logical sort in order to make this point. Well, then maybe nothing determines it. Maybe we live in a nihilistic intellectual world. Okay, that's a possibility too. But are you prepared to say, ladies and gentlemen, that for this reason, a question like, what compels the electron to follow its orbit, is meaningless? I don't think so. We recognize the question as deeply significant. Here we stand at a very considerable remove from what Galileo thought of as the book of God's work. We're reaching questions that the book cannot answer and that its interpreters cannot read. It is quite true that the scientific community believes you are weighed in the balances and found wanting. But that is a maxim that cuts two ways, doesn't it? There's nothing preventing us from saying, with respect to the scientific community, here are questions. And we are prepared to say, you are weighed in the balances and found wanting because you cannot answer the questions that haunt and oppress us. That is the second example, it seems to me. One of the dominant convictions urged upon the human race by the scientific community concerns a certain myth that the progress of science, which is real, which is very powerful, which is very significant, no one should doubt it, has meant progressively a disenchantment with nature and a form of cultural humiliation whereby at every step in the development of the sciences, human beings and their works have been demoted from a central position and reduced to the margins. Apparently, Stephen Jay Gould, for example, argues this, this process began in the 16th century with the discovery that in fact, the Earth is not the center of the universe. It continued step by step over the course of three centuries, and it reached an apogee with Darwin and the discovery that, in fact, human beings are nothing but a continuation, squalid enough, of the animal kingdom, cousin and kin to every shambling and repulsive thing that lives, and hardly distinguished from the great apes except for the acquisition of a few adventitious characteristics of no particular significance. Get used to it. Now this, I think, has been drummed into popular consciousness with absolutely no interruption. Each step of this progression is, of course, absurd. No one who believes that the Earth is the center of the universe is prepared to make purely a geographical argument. Home is where the heart is, not where geography points. And if we say that the Earth is at the center of the universe, we mean something quite different than the geometrical center. The supposed demotion of human beings as being created in the image of God proceeds by means of the ascent of an inferential staircase that any thinking person can see is on the verge of collapse. For example, I admire Stephen Jay Gould. I must say that. I think he was a sensitive and intelligent writer. But he said some lamentably foolish things. He said that the insistence, as I would insist, on a difference in kind and not simply in degree between us and the great apes is simply a mark of our cosmic arrogance, an inability to let go. But in fact, any cursory examination of the great apes and human beings reveal profound and striking differences, not only in the organism itself, biomechanically, physically, biochemically, but above all in its nature and soul. Here's a simple operational test, which I've mentioned many times to the community of evolutionary biologists. You're having trouble distinguishing a difference in kind rather than degree between you and a chimpanzee. Here's a simple test. The chimps are on the other side of the cage. You're not. It's quick, it's effective, it's operational, and it's infallible. Chimpanzees don't talk, they don't do mathematics, they don't speculate, they don't cook, they can't clean up after they make a mess, they dine inadvertently, they don't dance, they don't do music, they can't play an instrument. What more do you want as a difference in kind rather than degree? What more do you want? But there's an underlying, much more powerful argument. We know that human beings have some striking properties, and we know that the idea that a human being is not simply an animal has a very rich history, a very long tradition, and it seems to resonate very clearly with something in the human soul. According to Darwinian theory, even the psychological, the social, the cultural, and the religious attributes of the human being were introduced into the inanimate world in precisely the same way as any other biological structure. That is, incrementally by a process of random variation and natural selection. This is, if not holy writ, then certainly holy dogma. Alfred Wallace, who discovered the theory of evolution a little before Charles Darwin, was struck by this. He couldn't quite reconcile what he understood with what he was claiming. In that respect, he was a very honest scientist, very penetrating intelligence. He said, look, you go to the Amazon forest, you take an Amazonian headhunter, age of 6 months, family of headhunters. You move them to Oxford in England, give them a classical English education. The children of the Amazonian headhunters will be in all respects indistinguishable from other graduates of Oxford. That is to say, they'll speak perfect English, they'll have a wonderful ethnic advantage that they can use in acquiring positions at the BBC, namely that they're headhunters. They will be able to do mathematics, they can learn medicine, if they wish to dance, they can do anything they want. But Wallace said the remarkable thing is, human life, unlike chimpanzee life, human life seems to offer us this very suggestive account of unopened gifts in the human community. Now, if all these marvelous properties that human beings have developed in this way, how is it that we can go to an Amazonian community or the community of Eskimos and we can discover these gifts waiting and dying to be used? If those gifts are part of the human inheritance, they are not Darwinian. And if they are Darwinian, they are not there, because unused gifts have no role to play in the struggle for survival. After all, speaking with a polished BBC accent does a headhunter no good. This has been called Wallace's problem in the literature. And of course, biologists are happy to call it Wallace's problem, because it sounds so much safer than saying human beings are created in the image of God. That cannot be said, even though it comes to the same conclusion. So here we have, I think, another large area, a rich and a resonant area, where prevailing doctrines about the centrality of human life and the importance of the powers and properties of the human imagination are retrograde to the scientific community's assessment of where things stand and what they mean.
In the preceding segment, Berlinski illustrated the ills of modern scientism with a look at the social phenomena of the new atheism, which he weighs in the balance and finds wanting. In the next and final segment, available soon, Berlinski closes out his talk on the, quote, arrogance of the scientific community, end quote, and takes questions from the audience. This has been ID the Future. I'm Joshua Youngkin. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.